From the Moan Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, Hollywood movies get their first report cards for gender balance. Then, while researching a new play about the U.S.-Mexico border, writer and actor Richard Montoya found himself in an uneasy interview with controversial sheriff Joe Arpaio.
Joe is very different in his office. I became Richie. Hey, Richie, come over here. He had a pinky ring. And if I hadn't stopped myself, I wanted to have a drink with Uncle Joe, you know?
An American contemporary ballet gets a toehold in L.A.'s dance scene from the 32nd floor of a downtown high-rise. All that coming right up.
KPCC supporters include Freeform's Grownish, produced by ABC Signature Studios, Emmy-eligible for Outstanding Comedy Series, lead actress Yara Shahidi, and contemporary costumes. Episodes available at Freeform.com, the Freeform app, and Hulu.
Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. Today, 12 films were recognized with a new mark of distinction, the Reframe stamp. They include Wonder Woman, Lady Bird, and Girls Trip.
Liz.
Yeah.
Can I say this out of love?
Preach, girl.
Please refrain from saying things like preach or go, girl.
Why can't I just make the eggs?
Because you take too long, you make a big mess, and I have to clean the whole thing up.
What is a secretary?
Ooh, well, I do everything. I go where he tells me to go, and I do what he tells me to do.
Oh, well, where I'm from, that's called slavery.
I really like her.
The group Reframe is made up of people working in the industry who want the studios and networks to actively close the gender gap in hiring. They'll be releasing a list of TV shows getting the stamp later this year. For this first movie list, they only looked at the 100 highest-grossing releases in the U.S. from last year. Studios voluntarily submitted their films for assessment, and the people at Reframe partnered with the Internet Movie Database, more commonly known as IMDb, to crunch the numbers. To find out more about the process, I Skyped with Kathy Schulman. She's an Oscar-winning producer and the co-founder of the group, Reframe.
The first step is for the industry itself to start to self-regulate. And then as the stamp of quality makes us proud about our work, the consumer also can share in understanding how their content was made, kind of like, how was your food made? You know, are the, you know, ingredients organic? Are you drinking from a bottle, you know, where the plastic is safe, or that you're not using plastic alone? The concept is that especially amongst younger people, younger generations, that there is a concern about where things come from, how they're made, and what kind of moral compass informed the creation.
So I want to ask you about the criteria for how a film is awarded a Reframe stamp. I understand it involves points. Is there a number of points that a film has to get in order to get the stamp? And how do you end up accumulating points to get you there?
Essentially, a film has to get 4 out of 8 points or more to receive the stamp. And the algorithm includes who's producing the movie, who's writing the movie, who's directing the movie, who's performing in the movie, and how the movie is crewed. And that's broken up into 8 different segments or categories that are examined mathematically.
So it's obvious that there are certain films that, off the top of my head at least, would qualify, and I think you have recognized them, films like Lady Bird, Wonder Woman, Girls Trip, and those are films that feature women and are either written or directed by women. And then there's a movie like Shape of Water, which is directed by a man, Guillermo del Toro, but co-written by a woman. Is the idea that you can be inclusive enough to include films that don't obviously at first glance meet the criteria?
Absolutely. This is not a content stamp of approval, and it's completely unrelated to content. What we're really concerned about is that the people that were allowed to work on the movie and the people's lives who are portrayed in the movie better represent the world in which we live. It's not about the story. It's entirely about the process.
But doesn't that mean that a film could qualify for the stamp with points, be directed by a woman, be written by a woman, star women, and be incredibly misogynistic or demeaning to women? Is that not something that you're concerned about, or is that not what you're charged with?
I think that the possibility exists, and it's something that we've talked about long and hard. But we aren't here to judge the way that people utilize their artistic expression. We're firm believers in the right to say and create whatever you want. I think the likelihood that women would be able to put together finance and hit the top 100 markers where we're looking at these films right now in that way is probably unlikely, and we hope it's unlikely, but no, we would, if there were a movie of that type, we would be in a really tricky position, but we would have to award the stamp, and we would just not be making an opinion on their freedom of speech.
You also count different kinds of points for women and then women of color. Why is that important?
We have added additional points for women of color in an effort to focus on the intersectionality of inclusion, because it's just it's a statistical fact that a woman who is also a woman of color will have less opportunity to make content, to create content, and to star in content. And understanding that delicate relationship is what inspired us to sort of double point a situation where the woman is also diverse.
So you have been an activist for equal representation, equal pay, and you're also a producer, and you're in the middle of shooting a movie. When you think about the movie that you're working on now, the movies that you might be working on in the future, are you consciously calculating whether or not your films will qualify for the stamp?
Absolutely. Every minute. I'll tell you, the hardest part is the crewing. You know, we have so much work to do to better establish a pipeline. And every time I fail to create equality in any department or in any way, I feel like an abject failure. And it makes me realize how much harder we have to, you know, fight. That said, I'm starting a movie right now for Netflix that's called Otherhood, and it's a movie about middle-aged women. And I've been trying to get it made for like 7 years. So I think that the times are changing in the sense that this movie, which, by the way, stars Patricia Arquette, Angela Bassett, and Felicity Huffman, it's called Otherhood, that this movie, you know, about women in their 50s, I hope they don't kill me for saying that, but anyway, that we could get this done is already a sign of the changing times, but it doesn't make crewing it or putting it together or figuring it out on market or anything else any easier.
Kathy, thanks so much for coming on the show. Get back to producing your movie.
All right. Thank you, John. It was nice to talk to you.
Coming up, the satire trio known as Culture Clash first mined the U.S.-Mexico border for a play 20 years ago. They've revisited the region for a funny yet sobering update.
KBCC podcasts are supported by Freeform's The Bold Type, produced by Universal Television. Emmy eligible in all categories, including Outstanding Drama Series, and Freeform's Grown-ish, produced by ABC Signature Studios. Emmy eligible in all categories, including Outstanding Comedy Series, Outstanding Lead Actress in a Comedy Series for Yara Shahidi, and Outstanding Contemporary Costumes. Episodes available at Freeform.com, the Freeform app, and Hulu.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. The Latino performance troupe Culture Clash is known for its satirical approach to political and social issues. 20 years ago, the troupe's co-founders, Richard Montoya, Rick Salinas, and Herbert Siguenza, created Border Town, a comedy theater piece about the U.S.-Mexico border. Now they've joined forces with actress Sabina Zuniga Varela and director Diane Rodriguez for a sometimes funny, sometimes sobering reimagining of their original show. The update is called Border Town Now.
I will do anything to be with my son. Breaking the United States law, if I have to, of course I will do it.
But can you see a legal path to U.S. citizenship, Julie?
I can see a path, but it's very dark.
The Pasadena Playhouse, under the new leadership of Danny Feldman, premiered the play last week. It tackles issues such as President Trump's proposed border wall, the 2012 slaying of a 16-year-old boy in Mexico by the U.S. Border Patrol, and the perilous journeys taken by many Mexican immigrants through the southern Arizona desert. To inform the new play, interviews were conducted along the border with militiamen, charity workers, and even with controversial Sheriff Joe Arpaio. When I spoke with Culture Clash co-founder Richard Montoya, he started with the questions they tried to answer in this updated version of Border Town.
How could we really super try to understand what a fully armed militia guy is doing at the border? What's going on in Sheriff Joe Arpaio's mind? Who are the actual people at the border working both sides and gathering souls, or the idea of Christian charity? And that's where we met the Latter-day Saint missionaries, the Sisters of Mercy, the Jesuits at the comedores where they feed not just Mexican immigrants, but Central American immigrants. We had our work cut out for us, and I think that we pretty much had to leave the sketch comedy guys behind, and even the activists and the poets behind just a bit, so we could get, I guess, as you might say, behind enemy lines.
One of the central stories in the opening scene involves you and your colleague, Rick Salinas, conducting research for the show, mostly along the border near Arizona. And the two of you run across or confronted by an American vigilante. He's played by your other colleague, Herbert Seguenza.
You can color me any way you want. If protecting my country puts a black hat on me, I'll gladly wear it.
Well, when you strip away due process from brown suspects only, it colors you a bad guy, amigo.
Color's got nothing to do with it.
Why come only white guys say that?
He's trying to protect the border from drug runners and people that he doesn't want coming in the country, but he turns out to be a much more complicated figure once we get to know him. Is he an amalgam of real people? Is he somebody that you actually encountered? Where does that character come from?
He comes from many sources, but yes, we sat with a group of vigilantes and police officers and border agents and tried to walk in the boots of that sort. And how in the world would we make a fully armed vigilante a human being? Well, it turns out, like I felt with Joe Arpaio, that we had some uncommon commonalities that frankly surprised us.
Another character who's prominent in the story is Sheriff Joe Arpaio, who is famous for racial profiling, and last year he was found guilty of criminal contempt.
You liberal writers, you journalists, you like to come in my office all those decades and find some dirt on me, some sexy stuff in my background, but you never could find anything, could you? And the only way to go after Sheriff Joe was to lie about him, say he's a racist, he's a so-and-so, he's all this and all that. But you couldn't find anything, nothing sticks, so here I am, I'm still standing, baby, smoking Joe.
Why is Arpaio important to the story, and did you actually end up interviewing him in real life? Because there, unless it's doctored, unless it's fake news, it looks like you actually got a chance to meet with Arpaio.
Well, we kind of tricked our way in. Sheriff Arpaio thought that we were film students from ASU because we had a partnership with ASU.
Film students in your 25th year. Okay.
Bring the kids in. Or who are, you know, and we walk in and we're in our 50s. And he looks at me. I had my Stetson hat on. And the gambit there was, let's go in. No flip-flops, no shorts. Let's meet the sheriff on this professional level and in a sense, you know, leave the activists and leave the poet. I had 20 things to nail him on, but we went in and we were told, you know, 15 minutes, the sheriff's only got 15 minutes. And the amount of time that we were there, his guys are Googling me and, you know, I've only been in a few movies, but he knew what they were. And my father fought in Korea and he fought in Korea, and that my mother is very Catholic and his wife is very Catholic, the Arpaios. And I began to look around and mix the softballs in with the hardballs. But if we went in attacking him head on, he'd probably shut down and we would have been there 15, 20 minutes. But I think by playing a little bit on his ego and playing a little bit up to him, we were able to say, hey, let's talk about the federal indictment that's coming down. And we're not your parents, Italian immigrants. What's the difference between them and the immigrants coming in? And he sort of squirmed and hemmed and hawed a bit. But we just kept him talking. And in the 4 hours, he, you know, people say the darndest things when you keep them talking.
How much of that conversation is verbatim in the play?
Truth is, we're dramatists, and on stage we take some minor liberties, but I have to say 85-90% of the Joe Arpaio interview on stage is true. And then the other 10-15% is things that we've read. You know, Joe is very different in his office. I became Richie. Hey, Richie, come over here. And he separated me from the pack, a very good tactic. So he was playing to my sensibilities too. Hey, Richie, come over here. And he had the pinky ring, and And he played for me on his desk a little old spool reel-to-reel, and it was My Way. It was Frank Sinatra singing My Way. And it was like, if I hadn't stopped myself, I wanted to have a drink with Uncle Joe, you know? But you forget that his actions have led to extreme situations and even death among people in that part of the Arizona desert.
The show also includes a lot of topical references to journalists and to Mexican citizens who've been killed on the Mexican side of the border by Border Patrol officers. Why is it important that you illustrate those stories of those people who were killed on the Mexican side of the border by U.S. Border Patrol agents?
I stood in the home of Jose Antonio Elena Rodriguez, the kid that was shot, in a very bizarre case of U.S. border agents, you know, putting those long rifles through the slats of that particular part of the Nogales, USA, Nogales, Mexico part of the border to shoot inside Mexico was seemed very unusual. And this kid, Jose Antonio, was a good kid, the eldest of all his siblings, had a basketball and a backpack in his hands. And standing in the home of his grandmother, I was struck by her, when she was looking at us as a kind of a film crew that had come from the U.S., her husband having kicked out the BBC the day before, looking at us like, I don't have much time to talk to you. My husband will be home soon and he will not like this. But the wariness in her eyes and the hope in her eyes that we might carry the story forward impacted me.
We're talking with Richard Montoya. He's a member of Culture Clash and the co-writer of Border Town Now. There are references in the show to things that are incredibly current, like Roseanne Barr. At what point do you stop adding stuff and just say, we got to put on the show and we can't update it anymore?
Well, I think we swap out, you know, and that's the diligence and the duty of Culture Clash and the freedom that Diane Rodriguez, our director, who directed a tight and beautiful show. It's not a night of improv, but should something come up and should the Roseanne situation become old news, should Rudy Giuliani say something new and intelligent, and should President Clinton say something, you know, surprising. We're trying to keep up with the news. There is a line in the play, man. We used to do satire, and that echoes through the canyons because we're not doing satire anymore. We're kind of doing stark reality now.
Well, let me ask you the stark reality question. A lot has changed about the border from 1998 to 2018. How have you and your colleagues changed in how you think about it and the stories that you want to tell about it?
I think the empathy, you know, has changed. Our understanding, I mean, 20 years ago, I was really trying to get that laugh and to keep moving. And I think that we weren't reflecting enough. You know, we don't have to gun for the laugh. And I think that we did that 20 years ago. It was all about the laugh was our measuring stick. And now the measuring stick is that distance thunder, that distant gunfire, those things that happen in the desert. You know, the Saguaro Desert, that place between Nogales and Tucson is the most visited desert in the world, and for its beauty, you know, and the beauty is unmistakable, and the amount of death in that desert is also unmistakable. There's a measuring stick somewhere in there that baffles us.
There's a piece of video that I found incredibly disturbing, and that is that Good Samaritans leave water behind so that people don't perish in the desert as they're crossing.
Right.
And there is video image of people kicking over those water bottles so that anybody who comes along in desperate need of a drink will actually not have one.
The desert is serious business. You know, we also met scholars and Tohono O'odham natives of that area, authors of so many of those water stations that drive around filling up the water, and then those that are destroying the water. And so the rationale is that those people that come across an empty bottle of water will be forced into civilization and giving themselves up. But there is record of people perishing out there because there simply is no water. And so that information is real and not made up. And we were out in that desert, it seemed like, for months and trying to understand the rationale of those that would destroy a water station for those crossing and trying to find sustenance.
Richard Montoya, along with Herbert Seguenza and Rick Salinas, are Culture Clash. Their latest show, Border Town Now, which is directed by Dan Rodriguez, is at the Pasadena Playhouse through June 24th. Richard, thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much, man.
Now we're going to pay a visit to the 32nd floor of the Block Building in downtown Los Angeles. It's where the American Contemporary Ballet Company rehearses and performs all of its shows. With floor-to-ceiling windows, the space provides a 360-degree view of Los Angeles and its surroundings, visually fulfilling the company's mission to bring ballet into the modern world. I recently sat in on a rehearsal for ACB's upcoming show, The Spectacular Balanchine. And I spoke with artistic director Lincoln Jones. He, along with executive director Teresa Farrell, brought American Contemporary Ballet to Los Angeles in 2011. Teresa also dances in the company. During rehearsal, Lincoln, Teresa, and I talked about what sets their company apart from the classical ballet experience.
We started very unusually. Most ballet companies build on their Nutcracker and the traditional ballets and sneak in some new works. We, from the very beginning, were 100% new works, and we started sneaking in the older repertory as we went along. I love surprises. I love people coming to something that is completely different than what they expected. And so sometimes the audience, I mean, a lot of our audience will tell you that they have, one of the things I think they like about us is that they just literally have no idea what's going to be happening, but they seem to enjoy it.
I want to ask you too about the way the audience sees a show here. There's not balconies, there's not an orchestra, there's not a mezzanine. Your audience would have to be pretty much on the level of the dancers. How does that change the way that the audience experiences and sees dance that they may not be able to do in a traditional ballet setting?
Well, we do have live music. It's smaller than a traditional orchestra would be, of course, because of where we are. But I think the visceral aspect of it becomes much more present and you can feel it much more. I think that's one of the things that people come away with is how strongly you can feel the movement. The music is right behind you. And when you see something very far away, it's literally smaller. And, you know, I thought people today, most of their theatrical and entertainment experiences through film, you know, where it's this big to your eye line. And I wanted to do something that would replicate that for dance. And so this was the way to do it.
And what does it require of the dancers? And how does it change the dancer's relationship to the audience when the audience is only a couple of feet away?
I don't know. There's an energy, and you feel it after the shows. You really feel it when you get to talk with the audience afterwards and have a drink. That is more of a shared experience, I would say. It's more live. I mean, sometimes you can even feel the floor shake a little bit with us jumping. And then we only perform with live music also, so you have the musicians right behind you, the dancers there. You can hear the breathing. Depending on the ballet, sometimes we'll even enter through the audience. So you're really in it. It's not removed, and I like that.
I want to ask you about the thing you're rehearsing now. It's to a piece by Leonard Bernstein. There's lots of kind of like small movements within the piece. There's a lot of change of melody and rhythm. How did you end up picking it, and why is it important to the company?
Well, it's the Bernstein Centennial, and I thought so it would be nice to do something to Bernstein, which I never have. And we already had our programs somewhat set, but I needed a small piece. And so I love his overtures to his musicals. And, but it was interesting when I brought it, I thought, you know, can I make some kind of logical choreographic sense, a narrative sense out of an overture? Because you have this series of themes, kind of coming at you one after the other without being developed. And what I ended up doing was kind of envisioning it as this single male dancer on stage that keeps getting hit with different women. Each of them represent a theme. And, you know, Wonderful Town, what this is from, is about New York. And I think there's something about New York for everyone that goes there. There's probably a series of relationships with people that are more sophisticated than you are that end up sort of changing your worldview. So I think that was a bit of the inspiration.
And how do you see this company in LA? What is its relationship to the city, and how do you hope it's recognized along with other dance companies in LA?
I think that American Contemporary Ballet is a unique part of LA in that we perform in a setting that isn't an old theater. We're in a skyscraper. And after every show, you meet all the other artists. There's a sense of community. It's accessible and it can be a part of your everyday life in a really fun and engaging way. And also, we believe that great dance is entertaining. And this is a town built on entertainment. And that's important in our ballets as well.
I think Los Angeles is the place for dance right now. I think it's shifted a little bit. And what's exciting about LA and what's different about here is that there's space for you to create your own thing. What is important to us is, and what I think makes our company different, is the new work. We do a lot of new works following the tradition of Balanchine, where his ballets evolved from the score. And I think that that's an extremely important tradition to the future of dance. And so we're really happy to be having that here in LA.
How important is it that your company and other companies make sure that kids are being educated about dance and that the next generation of dancers recognizes that there's a place for them, that there's a job out there, and that it can actually be a calling and a profession?
I think that having a place where dancers' training can go and work is hugely, hugely important. There's a lot of schools, but having jobs in Los Angeles so that really good dancers don't train here and then leave for other cities. So having jobs here for those dancers, and of course having that next generation is extremely important. One thing we also do with that is we have an adult education program, because a lot of a love of classical art is passed down through parents. So we educate and the adult and the child, and I think that it all nurtures more of a love of dance and an understanding of dance.
Lincoln, Teresa, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having us.
American Contemporary Ballet performs its Balanchine program tonight through Sunday, and then again June 14th through the 17th. For more information, go to acbdances.com. And that's our show for today. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. We'll see you back here tomorrow.